You're listening to Queers, a podcast about politics and culture with Simon Copland and Benjamin Riley.
I'm just saying some things, you know, just talking.
Me too, now I'm just talking as well, saying some things, good. More things.
It's good quality content.
Yeah. No wonder we're so popular. It's the 25th of January, 2017. I'm Simon Copland.
And I'm Benjamin Riley.
Welcome to Queers. Each episode we talk our way through questions on a theme, and this week we're talking about homophobia.
So before we get into the topic, I just wanted to tell a strange and kind of quite lovely story that I had about a listener. It's kind of gotten to the point, I don't know if this is true for you as well, Simon, but like, I feel like, you know, we've been doing this for a year now. We don't really do much in the way of kind of marketing the podcast or actively getting people to listen other than through our personal networks and our friends. But I'm really starting recently to get feedback from people who I don't know, which is really cool. I was looking at the kind of, you know, where people listen to our podcast the other day, and they're like, we really get people listening from all over the world, which is really quite amazing. There's, you know, people from Europe, from North America, from like people from Africa, from Asia, and that
I haven't seen those stats.
Yeah, well, I have to show you. It was genuinely really cool. So a friend of mine was visiting from the UK recently, and she told me that she put a friend of hers, a gay guy she knows over there, onto the podcast, and he's gotten really into it. So, you know, I've never met this dude, and so she asked me to record a greeting to him to say hello, which was obviously the most awkward thing I've ever done in my life. So, you know, hopefully he's listening to this. And I've momentarily forgotten his name, so, God, I'm an asshole. But it was...
Oh, the story was so good up until that point.
I know. I've really wrecked it. But anyway, it was just this kind of, lovely experience, and as awkward as it was, really kind of cool to know that people are listening to us from not only people we don't know, but people from all over the world.
Yeah, that's really, really cool. I like to hear that.
So, awesome. So thank you to everyone who's listening to the show, and people who continue to leave lovely reviews for us on iTunes. If you haven't, just do it right now. Just pause the podcast and do it.
Yeah. And I've had a couple of bits of feedback every now and then, and it's, I really do appreciate it. It sort of keeps me motivated to keep going. It makes me, I don't know, realize that we're not just speaking into a void, which is often how it feels.
Yeah.
So it's nice. It's nice not to be feeling like that.
It is nice. So to get back into the topic, I've been thinking about this a bit over the past few months, about kind of homophobia broadly as an idea, particularly since the US election last year. And now it's been almost a week since Donald Trump's inauguration as US president. And since then, particularly, community conversations have flared up about a need to stand against homophobia, among other bigotries, from Trump's administration.
And homophobia is often explicitly a starting point for political action by gay communities. And yet, we often tie the idea of homophobia to recognisable acts of bigotry, like verbal or physical abuse that many of us rarely experience. And so we were thinking, is homophobia a useful framework for political action, or do we need more complex ways of talking about homophobia?
It's important to say here too, because this has come up before, that given the amount we'll probably be drawing on our own experiences in this discussion, we don't want to even imply any universal implications for all queer people.
Yeah, and in doing so, we've limited the language we're using to frame the discussion to gay and homophobia, rather than talking about, for example, biphobia or transphobia, though these topics may come up today. That's not because we want to erase those experiences, but largely because we don't want to accidentally come across as speaking to experiences that neither of us have had.
So I thought a good place to start would be to reflect on our own experiences of homophobia. Simon, can you think about instances in the past, maybe significant instances, or even in your day-to-day life, where you do face homophobia?
I think that's a really interesting question because I guess despite the amount of time that I spend thinking and talking about issues related to homophobia and queerness, the answer is largely no. I faced a pretty welcoming situation when I came out and with my friendship circle and continue to face that today. And so on a day-to-day level, I don't actually face significant amount of homophobia, if at all, at least not that I can recognize. I can think of one real instance where that occurred and one that had a major impact on me, and that was when I did come out when I was 16 or 17. I had one friend who was a very, very good friend of me at the time, who didn't react particularly well. So it was only one out of all of my friends, but he was quite a religious person, and sort of didn't reject me entirely, but just sort of said basically that he thought because of being gay that I would go to hell and that kind of stuff, and that really affected our relationship. It's a relationship that we've since patched up, and he's since apologized for those comments, and I've accepted that apology and we've moved on. But since then I can't really name that sort of personal stuff that's we can talk about maybe later about the sort of the Donald Trumps and the big the bigger experiences, but that sort of personalized homophobia, no, I can't particularly name something that I can really point to that says, that's an experience of homophobia targeted towards me. How about you, Ben?
Yeah, I mean, my experience is similar, which I think is really what was the starting point for me of wanting to talk about this. So there are some instances, I grew up in a country town in Victoria, and I can absolutely remember homophobic, like verbal abuse being directed towards me in high school, even though I wasn't out, like it kind of was just a default way of bullying sort of kids who maybe weren't, who were a bit more effeminate, I suppose. Yeah, I guess like since then, I mean, there were I remember a few years ago walking down a street in Melbourne with my then partner, and a woman yelled faggots at us, but it was a bit confronting at the time, but it was also, she clearly seemed to be sort of experiencing some sort of mental illness and didn't seem to be in a good way. So I didn't really take much away from that.
Yeah.
But funnily enough, I had an experience very recently where I was, just a couple of months ago, was walking through the CBD in Melbourne, and like a teenage boy who was walking with a teenage girl, like said to me, "Your socks make you look gay," but like yelled it at me in a way that I was, I don't know how I was supposed to respond to that. Like
that's an interesting thing to decide to say.
Yeah, totally. And I guess it was a homophobic insult. I didn't say anything. I was just kind of so surprised and was confused, I guess, that I didn't say anything in response. And then afterwards, I was just like, I thought of like a really kind of sexually explicit comeback that I could have made that I won't repeat because it's probably a bit gross. Other than that, yeah, I can't think of many instances. I mean, something that I think that we'll get into maybe a bit later is that I have reflected on my experiences of homophobia a lot in ways that don't look like that don't look like these sorts of really recognizable instances. And so, I would absolutely say that I do experience homophobia on a daily basis, but that it maybe can't be tied to these sorts of recognizable symbolic incidents that we would describe as homophobic.
Yeah, I think that's potentially interesting. And maybe you said that's something we can get into later, but maybe that's something we want to get into now.
Sure, sure. I suppose something I just wanted to touch on before then is because I was thinking about... So the what kind of got me thinking about this whole topic was I was at a I was at a gig and there were the musicians were talking about Donald Trump and one of the musicians who's a friend of mine told a story about being sitting next to like a straight couple who were making out on a bus and feeling kind of really uncomfortable because he felt like he couldn't do the same thing if he was there with a partner, and that was sort of somehow tied to Donald Trump, and I guess the kind of implied sort of, I don't know, archetypal bigotry that we associate with him. And I was just kind of standing there in the audience and going, like, just having feeling like I had very little emotional connection to it. Like when people talk about Donald Trump as this sort of uber bigot, not being able to connect that to my own experiences of homophobia.
Yeah. And was the sort of the implication that, you know, because Donald Trump exists and is now president, that those experiences of homophobia are going to be more common, or was his implication their implication that because of Donald Trump they feel increasingly uncomfortable about those sorts of expressions?
I guess so. I feel like that connection is sometimes not even explicitly made, but you know that somehow invoking him is like this. Like to recognize that everything's worse now. So I suppose it was a bit more sort of nebulous than that.
But it's interesting, I guess, that idea that everything's worse now because of him, and that somehow there's like almost a trickle down homophobia that occurs. And I think that you know, that okay, so Donald Trump says these things, and you know, then that means that we're all suddenly living in a less safe space.
Yes.
A less safe world in terms of that sort of interpersonal homophobic experiences that may occur. And I think I probably agree with you in that I don't connect emotionally with that at all. I myself, and again, I think we should just reinforce that this is not trying to connect to other people's experiences, but
of course,
I myself have not experienced that, or have not witnessed that, and don't fear that in any ways that Donald Trump is somehow suddenly going to mean that I'm going to be facing abuse walking down the streets if I hold my partner's hand or kiss on a bus or anything like that. And I've not felt that at all. And I don't feel that, you know, I live in Canberra, which is quite a progressive place, but I don't think I'd feel that in other places either. At least not places I would tend to go to. So I don't have that emotional connection either. It's interesting.
Yeah. It's funny because, you know, and it, you know, again, I would just absolutely reiterate that is like clearly a lot of people have had that experience because there's been there have been a lot of I don't know, reports of that sort of thing happening, and I would absolutely acknowledge that probably both of our protection from that is a function of privilege or all sorts of privilege, you know, being that we're, you know, live in progressive sort of fairly wealthy areas, we're both white.
Yep.
We're both male, and I think also very importantly, we're both neither of us is particularly effeminate, which I think probably plays into it as well. So, I mean, I wondered too whether I was kind of thinking about this question of like the encounters with homophobia on a day-to-day basis, and what the responses maybe from people I know who are really sort of at least appear to me to be much more emotionally invested in this stuff. And I was just keep thinking about like marriage equality, you know, that I think for a lot of people, that's a really recognizable, I guess, experience of homophobic discrimination that is very concrete and that people feel like they are faced with on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. And I think that for me, that leads into the question and maybe it's partly one of the partly a defining question of this podcast, but of this episode. And but I think it's a really interesting question in and of itself in terms of what is homophobia, or what are we talking about when we actually say the term homophobia? Because as we said in the introduction, we equate it largely with the sort of physical or verbal abuse, you know, homophobia in the streets kind of stuff. But this sort of government-based homophobia, or that sort of more silent, I guess, homophobia, the kinds of things which is not right in your face, but might be behind your back, or sort of some sort of being denied access to particular things, or just sort of not being as much a part of a community, for example, or part of a workplace because of your sexuality, or even things like the process of having to come out, for example, or have people ask you questions about your sexuality. Are they forms of homophobia? Or what does that mean, and how does that work within terms of people's personal experiences, but also in terms of, you know, sort of a political resistance or a political program, and, you know, and how we shape these ideas, because they're different things in many ways. The experience of being, you know, have someone, for example, screaming faggot at you while you're walking down the street, or the experience of being bashed because of your sexuality, is different to that sort of it's not like a less intense, but it's a different sort of discrimination. The process of having to come out and being asked questions, and the not being involved in, they're not being able to get married, or even that kind of stuff where you see a lot of people who are really emotionally, and I see this increasingly, emotionally invested in going to straight weddings. And I see lots of articles about this recently, where you're going to straight weddings and feeling the homophobia of not being able to participate, that kind of stuff. They're very different sorts of things, and it's hard. It's interesting. Using homophobia as a framework for those very different things can, I think, have its issues, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, and I think for me, the diversity of experiences that you've just described really points to why I don't like, for example, and I would say this is true across the board, like not just of homophobia, but of really any kind of, you know, quote unquote bigotry. And this is something we have talked about on a previous podcast. I prefer not to kind of locate that in people, you know, to kind of think of homophobia as, for example, a trait that a person has. Mm-hmm. And I think almost what this conversation is pointing me to is that maybe I'm seeing even the limits of talking about homophobia in terms of acts. And that, you know, I talked about feeling like, despite not having experienced a lot of, not experiencing a lot of this stuff on a day-to-day basis, feeling like I face homophobia, I almost prefer to think of it as a, I don't know, like something much more diffuse, like a social idea, or a kind of discursive feature. That operates, you know, throughout society and affects different people and manifests in all sorts of different ways, and that we can still think about as a cohesive whole, but, you know, allows us maybe more analytical leeway than saying homophobia looks like this, or homophobic person is this. Does that make sense?
It does. I was just thinking about an experience I had, which is not really a homophobic experience, but it's... So I also am poly. I'm dating two people. And, I mean, I think more than coming out as gay, that has caused some issues. And I remember just last year, actually, having a chat with a friend of mine about... having an engagement with, a social event with a family member where both my partners were going to be there, and being concerned about how that was going to play out, and saying to this friend, I said, you know, I think it will be fine. Like, it will, you know, it won't be great, but it'll be okay. That kind of, you know, that this event will be okay. You know, we'll get through it, and that will be fine. You know, and But, you know, and then I was like, I guess that's okay. And my friend said something like, you know, well, this is, you know, this is what queer people face all the time, is that yes, things might be okay, but that doesn't mean they're good. You sort of go around with that sort of experience of always being the odd one out, or always being the one who has to explain yourself, or always being the one that it's you know, where things are just okay, and it's not, you know, and nobody else has to deal with that, or you know, I think people do in different other sorts of circumstances, but you know, in terms of, you know, sexuality, nobody else really has to deal with that. And that wasn't explicit forms of homophobia for me, or you know, if it was a similar situation, it wasn't like that explicit, you know, being bashed or having abuse yelled at me, or being ostracized even. It's not that. It's the level of sort of just being there, that sort of, it just, you know, it's, I would say it's systematic sort of homophobia is the kind of language that I would use, but it's that personal, you know, that at a personal level, it's the experience of that, just knowing that things are different and not quite right, but it's all to do with you. And even if it's not spoken necessarily, it's just there. And that, I think, is the different kind of, I don't know, for me, that's an experience of a different kind of homophobia of some form.
Sure. I mean, I suppose I would be, I would be reluctant to call it a different kind, because yeah, I feel like it's very much, I think, related to those more sort of explicit instances that we might imagine. And a lot of people experience, you know, I would want to call it something like, I don't know, like a different manifestation of the same phenomenon, you know, and that like what interested me about what you were saying is that you didn't at any point talk about explicit signals that you might receive from people at this event, or that you had received prior to this event, that would indicate to you that it might not be okay. And so I'm sort of interested in the relation, like at what point we internalize things like homophobia or any sort of bigotry, and I guess, yeah, I don't know what the implications are of that.
Yeah, I guess that's the interesting part. Like, going back to this conversation I had with my friend about this, about homophobia sort of just always being there, or queer people just walking around with it, I guess, is that there is that, I guess, there, you know, internalized homophobia is a term that's used quite often, but I think it's often used in a way of, like, talking about the gay conservative who hates, you know, hates himself, clearly, you know, or hates themselves. But I think it's more than that. Maybe it's not internalized homophobia in the sense, but it's an internalized sense of being lesser, or being different, or even just the fear. And I think this is something. It's just the fear that the next person you tell will be the person who has the problem, and that's something that I recognize in myself, particularly less so with being gay, but more so with being being in two relationships. The fear that I've told all of my good friends and my family know, and they're fine, but that, you know, that next work encounter I have when I start that new job, I'll tell someone that I'm dating two people, or that I'm gay, and that next encounter will be the one that causes the problem. And so it's like a continued fear almost that you can walk around with, that next thing. And for me, it's not so much, again, it's not about that street-based violence. I'm not fearful that I walk down the city center holding hands with my partner or with my partners, or that I will, you know, kiss on a bus or anything like that and fear that. It's that interpersonal, that, you know, not even that I'll get abused, but that person just, you know, just won't be okay, and that it'll be awkward and difficult. But also in some ways that the bigger problem is also that when those sorts of, you know, nobody I know would accept, you know, someone abusing someone on the street. You know, if anybody I knew no one would accept that. But those sorts of quieter forms of uncomfortableness, people are more willing to accept. you know, when someone in the family or the friends is that, you know, that sort of awkward about it or uncomfortable or wants explanations or demands those sorts of things, it's more accepting than people are more acceptful of that, more willing to forgive it or more willing to say, oh no, they just have to let them, give them time, you know, all that kind of stuff than if, you know, if someone walking down the street screaming abuse. And I think that's where there is a difference in these sorts of forms of homophobia, in that one, our society continues to accept largely to an extent. You know, I think that in places like Australia, in, you know, in the places that we live, if you were to walk down this, you know, central Melbourne or central Canberra or central Sydney and someone started screaming homophobic abuse, I don't think many people around that would accept it. But at that interpersonal family level, I think it continues to be accepted in an interesting kind of way.
I think part of the challenge with that also is that it becomes difficult to confront when you don't need to, you know, a structure, an idea like homophobia doesn't need much fuel to kind of keep alive, in terms of, like, for example, your fear of something happening. And so, you know, even if you only have one or two encounters like that, you know, it once it becomes internalized and once you kind of are fearing things regardless of whether or not they're going to be there, I mean, it's sort of impossible for the people around you to confront that and to support you to overcome that, because you can't see it. And I, you know, which to me raises questions around, you know, what might community responses look like to the sorts of, I just keep coming back to this idea of internalized homophobia, and I really like it. And I was interested in what you, I mean, I don't like internalized homophobia.
Yeah, sorry, that was what I was laughing at. You know, I love having internalized homophobia.
That's
great.
It's fun. But I'm really glad that you said that thing about conservative politicians as well, because I, you know, when I said that I don't like locating bigotry in particular people, that's part of the reason, because I think that by saying that the only people who have internalized homophobia are these, like, you know, conservative gay guys, for example, it gives us, it kind of makes it much harder for us to think about our own potential internalized homophobia, which I would really kind of struggle to think. I mean, it's so, homophobia is or let's say heteronormativity, you know, that kind of, that great word, is so pervasive that it's really hard for me to imagine that most gay people haven't internalized at least some of that. And when you're dealing with this stuff that is so, you know, doesn't maybe often have really concrete manifestations in day-to-day life, I mean, how can you... Yeah, again, how can we as a community deal with that when it feels so abstract, even, or invisible?
This is a good question, and I don't know, but I think, I mean, there's, oh, it's I mean, it's such a, as long as I get, I think that as long as homophobia exists in the world in terms of, in a systematic kind of way, I think that there's always going to be the potential that you'll have individual experiences of homophobia, at least in the near future. But as I think that, and that's, you know, even though it's a false separation, I think that's where there's the potential separation between the sort of the systematic structures that are homophobic and their potential individual experiences of that. One, I think, has a greater cause, causes the other a lot more than the other way around, and that I think systems impact those individual experiences. But so just as long as we have that systematic, a system based on homophobia.
And when you say a system, are you talking about, because I feel like I think about, like, kind of institutionalized discrimination in terms of, like, government and things like that, but do you mean, like, an ideological
system? I mean both.
Okay, yeah, sure. Because so to me, they're almost like slightly different things. Oh, it's almost like this kind of three-tiered thing, you know, where like heteronormativity is this sort of ideological structure that all of society operates under, that feeds into sort of institutional discrimination through things like law and access to services and things like that. And then that in turn feeds into, like, the production of homophobic violence, for example.
Yeah, yeah, I'd be happy with that sort of framework.
Sure.
So yeah, so when I was thinking about systematic, I was thinking about it in that sort of those top two tiers of the ideological system and the material system, which sort of feed off each other. So the material oppression and ideological understanding, which I think is are the forces behind individual experiences of oppression, and I think that's where, you know, I agree with you on the not having the idea of the not locating homophobia in the individual, like that sort of that person is a homophobe kind of thing, because it's, you know, people aren't born a homophobe, you know, you don't,
sure,
it doesn't, sure, it doesn't occur in some sort of weird vacuum. It occurs within a system of homophobia, occurs within a background of those experiences. And now I've lost where we were going with this.
Yes,
because
right.
We got caught up in fault. Systems and... that's all right, but we...
I think we would go... Like, what would a community response
So I think it's going to be really difficult in terms of actually, like, you know, if we were to live in the ideal world where queer people don't have internalized homophobia, from my view, it's really difficult as long as those structures of homophobia continue to exist. So those systems, in terms of the ideological narrative and the structural system, the physical, material, governments, laws, economic disadvantage, that kind of stuff. So I think, you know, the first one is to try and break down those systems of homophobia. In the, you know, that's a long-term project that I think we'd probably both agree with, you know.
Sure.
But the, I guess the short term, you know, it's hard, but, you know, I think there's a value and we can have discussions about what this means, but in a quote unquote queer community that is able to reinforce strength within ourselves, and able, that a community or whatever you want to call it, I guess, that is able not just to provide support when people face homophobic attacks, or when people are struggling with systematic homophobia, or when people are dealing with that kind of stuff, but is actually able to build up strength in terms focusing on positives rather than always just reacting to the, rather than being reactionary to the negatives. And so that's one that celebrates people rather than just responds to the negative attacks. And I fear that in recent years in particular, last year, that we've become, that this, you know, this queer community has become very reactionary to attacks rather than focusing on our own strength.
Defensive, you know.
Yeah. Defensive is a good term for it. I think the one that can get rid of sort of, you know, that can really work on things like internalized homophobia is one that is able to be more offensive, I guess, more on the offense. But also focuses in on itself, not just focusing on the legal reform. So it's like you've got to have that legal reform, you know, not just legal reform, legal and social reform is the big picture stuff. That we must continue to fight for, but part of the process of getting to that reform is being able to, I guess, almost, you know, liberate ourselves through a sense of community, and that means having some focus on ourselves as well.
Yeah, I mean, two things kind of came to mind while you were talking. I think, you know, really what one of the values of at least the potential of queer community, I think, can be. Is, you know, if you think about heteronormativity, like one of the implications of it is that gay people are other, you know, are just by default sort of different from this ideological norm. And so I think a gay community can be a really positive space for just like reinforcing selfhood, you know, for kind of creating a space where you are... I mean, normal's kind of a weird word to use, but, you know, it sort of works. Like, where you are not other, where you're not kind of abnormal in that space.
Sorry to cut. Or even, like, I think that's important, but or where your otherness is just celebrated as being a good thing.
Sure, sure.
You know, so you can say, yeah, we're other from those people over there, but that's fine. Because, you know, sometimes other is good. And I know that you mean other in that sort of, I guess, I'm guessing you're picturing in that sort of bigger picture of like his normal and his
But
yeah, I think there's value to that. Sorry, I cut you off.
No, I agree. And I guess the second thing, and it's interesting that you use the word liberation. Like I was just kind of thinking about, you know, this sort of like this tiered structure that we've just come up with, and I was thinking about second wave feminism, and that like a big part of the women's liberation movement was you know, about consciousness raising groups.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, this idea that women would sort of get together and like learn about feminism and learn about kind of the structural oppression of women, and that these were like sort of social gatherings that were explicitly about liberating the self, I guess,
yep.
In a sort of community setting, in a space that was supported and done, you know, together with other women. And I don't actually know whether I don't know as much about it in terms of gay liberation. I imagine that it happened. Yeah,
I have read about that. It was, you know, the early gay liberation movements. There was like splinter groups and more splinter groups. But there were some splinter groups that I know that focused on that sort of reading texts and getting together as groups. And I think it was more. It was quite a bit of a Marxist thread of the gay liberation movement that would read things like Engels and Marx and that sort of material as a way of learning and I agree with it in terms of liberating yourself as well.
And I suppose that speaks also to the like maybe the falsity of this sort of tiered imagining of homophobia in that it links very directly the experience of like a day-to-day experience with those kind of larger ideological structures, and that dismantling one is dismantling the other in some
sense. Interesting. I
wonder whether that kind of that's something that we could do better as a community. I mean, maybe not exactly the same model, but at least, you know, create safe spaces to be able to talk about this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's valuable, and I agree with you that it's something that we could do. That you know, if you think about queer spaces these days, they often don't have that community, that sense of community feeling, in terms of the stereotypical queer space. You know, bars are an amazing queer space and they have an amazing history, but my experience with queer bars is often clubs that you go out to get really sloshed and and try and pick up, and if you don't pick up, then you you've failed at going to the queer bar. But spaces where you can go and chat to other queer people in a comfortable environment, where you could talk about issues, where you could engage in that process, is different to that, and I think something that is often or largely missing. And there is a value to those sorts of places that I think that we're missing at this point in time.
Well, we should probably wrap it up there. We've kind of gone down an interesting sort of tangent, but I feel like I got a lot out of that.
One that I wasn't expecting.
No, me either.
But that means I think we could probably cover this topic again.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
All right. Well, thanks everybody for listening today, and we'll be back with another episode in a couple of weeks.
In the meantime, as always, you can catch us on queers.podomatic.com, which has our whole back catalogue of episodes, or subscribe to us on iTunes. And of course, please leave us a review and rating, please, 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 which will help people find us.
And in the meantime, you can find us online. I'm on Twitter at Simon Copland, and also on Facebook at Simon Copland Writer.
I'm also on Twitter at Ben C. Riley.
And we'll see you all next time.